This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, more highlights from the North Dakota Poetry Out Loud competition. But first, hard work and high pay don't always go together. In fact, some of the hardest working people are among the lowest paid. Stephanie Land learned that firsthand working as a maid. She visited with Sarah Aronson, host of The Right Question from Montana Public Radio, about her book, Maid, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive.
And Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote Nickel and Dimed, writes in the foreword, "If this book inspires you, which it may, remember how close it came to never being written." How did you trust that you had a story to tell?
Well, I think being a writer, that is kind of your purpose, is to share your story with people. As writers, we kind of share our story so that we don't feel alone. And so there was that aspect to it. But I really didn't think this part of my life was very interesting until the original article went viral. And suddenly I saw, like, oh, okay, well, maybe people do want to hear about this.
And the book shares experiences about being degraded and condescended and judged for your circumstance. And I want you to read a paragraph and then I want to talk to you about it.
Yeah, sure. "When people think of food stamps, they don't envision someone like me, someone plain-faced and white, someone like the girl they'd known in high school who'd been quiet but nice, someone like a neighbor, someone like them. Maybe that made them too nervous about their own situation. Maybe they saw, in me, the chance of their own fragile circumstances, that, with one lost job, one divorce, they'd be in the same place as I was."
There were heartbreaking moments when these encounters happened, like with medical staff and even assistance program staff, and as well as bystanders and checkout lines. What do you wish people understood about what it means to be in poverty?
Well, I think the common misconception is that we're not working and that we're choosing to not work and just kind of like sit back and like rake in all this government money that they think we're getting and doing that purposefully and not trying to improve our lives when really it's the opposite. Most people on government assistance are working to some extent and they have families and they have children and they need this assistance because their wages aren't nearly the amount that they should be. So it's a means of survival. It's not necessarily a means of taking advantage or being lazy. And so I wish that we would just kind of drop this notion of, you know, requiring proof of work when I think most people find a lot of pride and satisfaction in work and making ends meet and providing for their family. But it just seems like there's this judgment or stigma that people on government assistance don't have that drive.
You also write, "I'd wonder if the person's view of me would change if they knew I was on food stamps. Would they assume I had less potential?" So this sense of potentiality really struck me. What is the unseen potential of people in poverty?
I hear a lot. I've even heard it on book tour. People have asked me, like, it just seems like people in poverty just don't even try, or they don't know how to handle their finances. They don't know how to save or anything like that. And I'm kind of struck by how common that misconception is. I was not encouraged to get an education. I lost benefits because I was in school full time and wasn't able to work 20 hours a week. And so I was dropped from the food benefits program. And also, life was so bleak for so long. I didn't want to imagine 5 years from then because I didn't want to imagine that I would still be living the life that I was. So every single time that I got like an extra 10 bucks or something, I didn't think, oh, I need to save this. It was, I need to provide my daughter with a momentary joy that she could have. Because I felt like I could rarely give that to her. And just even getting her a Happy Meal was a special treat. As a parent, you want to be able to give that to your kid. And when I hear these things like, well, they just don't know how to save money, it's not that we don't know how. It's what are we saving for?
Right. But there was something about this book where you always had a dream about writing. So how did you keep that part of the dream alive?
I think being a writer for me was kind of like this nagging voice that constantly reminded me, but you're a writer. Being in the position that I was, being a writer meant being an artist and kind of like being this elite member of society that isn't really affordable or accessible to a lot of people in the lower classes. So I put it off as long as possible. And it was a huge risk to finally embrace it entirely and get a degree in English, which at the time I was just like, well, what in the world am I going to do with a degree in English? But I mean, it was also a drive not only just to do that for myself, but to do that for my kid. I wanted her to know that whatever she wanted to be, she could, in no matter what situation. I wasn't totally sure that I would be able to prove that to her, but I wanted to try as much as possible.
As a house cleaner, you wrote about becoming a witness, and I was hoping that you would read a little section on that too.
Sure. I became a witness. Even odder was my invisibility and anonymity, though I spent several hours a month in their homes. My job was to wipe away dust, dirt, and make lines and carpets to remain invisible. I almost felt like I had the opportunity to get to know my clients better than any of their relatives did. I'd learn what they ate for breakfast, what shows they watched, if they'd been sick, and for how long. I'd see them, even if they weren't home, by the imprints left in their beds and tissues on the nightstand. I'd know them in a way few people did, or maybe ever would.
I'm thinking about the invisibility of the work that you did, and the fact that you did it for minimum wage, and the toll it took on your body. What would you want people who hire house cleaners to know, you know, from the other side?
I had a guy interview me, and we went through this whole interview for a radio station or podcast or something, and he called me back a couple of days later, and he said, I just had a quick question for you. And I said, okay. And he said, I have to tell you, I have house cleaners, and it snowed a lot today, and they got stuck at the bottom of my driveway and then had to leave, and they were really worried about getting in trouble with their boss, and you know, I called their boss and said it was okay, and it wasn't any fault of theirs. But now I'm sitting here thinking, and after reading your book and talking to you, I just realized they're not going to get paid for those hours. So what can I do? And I was like, man, this is awesome that you're asking me this. And I said, you could offer to pay for it, even though they didn't clean that day. You know, make sure their boss knows that it was not any fault of theirs, that you're not upset. See if you can reschedule the clean. Because, yeah, those are wages that they're going to miss out on. I think a lot of people didn't really see that. Because to them, it was a disposable service that, oh, well, I'm homesick today. You don't need to come clean. When to me, that was $40 that was going to pay my electric bill that I wouldn't be able to make up or get back. It's a scary position to be in when you're truly dependent on other people's whims, that you have to constantly cater to those whims. And they don't even recognize that you're a human being most of the time, or that you have a life, or just how important that job is.
I love this sense of humanity, and it got me thinking about this part of the book that I knew I was bracing myself for, which is a part about snooping. And I really just want to have you read that tiny little section.
Oh, okay. For some houses, that meant I had time to stop and thumb through books sitting on nightstands or kitchen counters. I began looking through the rapidly growing stashes of alcohol, hidden chocolate, unopened bags from the mall that remained untouched for months. I became intrigued by understanding how people coped. I snooped because I was bored, and in a way, it became my own coping mechanism. I started to love the houses that didn't echo in vacancy. I appreciated my Friday mornings with Henry. I never snooped in houses where I wasn't invisible, where my name was Stephanie instead of cleaning service or even maid on their calendar. And I never looked through the stuff of clients I made on my own outside of Classic Clean. We had a mutual respect for each other, and over time, some became friends. The snooping was like uncovering clues, finding evidence of the secret lives of people who seemed like they had it all. Despite being wealthy and having the two-story houses of our American dreams, the marbled sink bathrooms, the offices with bay windows looking out at the water, their lives still lacked something. I became fascinated by the things hidden in dark corners and the self-help books for hope. Maybe they just had longer hallways and bigger closets to hide the things that scared them.
So the article that was published in Vox was called "I Spent 2 Years Cleaning Houses. What I Saw Makes Me Never Want to Be Rich." And I just want you to comment on the human condition. You know, that's what that paragraph to me signals, is that we're all trying to cope with something. What's your sense?
My sense was kind of one of disenchantment. I remember being surprised that my clients, who were, you know, much wealthier than me, upper middle class or whatever, I was surprised that they were affected by the common cold. Because I assumed that once you're in that position, you have access to yoga and doctors and medicine and kale and smoothies and like all of these things that are supposed to keep you healthy. And so it was really eye-opening for me that they had these common ailments and that they were still human beings, when I assumed the upper classes were kind of superhuman because they had somehow made it through all of these circumstances that I was still fighting against.
And had won like the immunity coin or something.
Yeah. Something like that. Or they had just made it and gone over to the other side where everything was perfect and happy and wonderful all the time.
That's Stephanie Land visiting with Sarah Aronson of The Right Question about her book, Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. We'll have more after this break.
Don't miss St. Stephen's Green when you're in Dublin.
Step out of the middle of this busy, packed city into a beautiful, manicured park.
Tim Egan explores the incredible story of Thomas Francis Marr.
Because you see almost the entire Irish-American story in one man's life.
And visit the rugged Aran Islands.
All three islands have got loads of great archaeological sites.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we're airing a conversation between Stephanie Land and Sarah Aronson. Sarah hosts the show The Right Question from Montana Public Radio, and she spoke with Stephanie about her book, Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive.
I was trying to identify the themes in this book, and obviously one is the trudge of just trying to crawl out of the place where the book begins, in a homeless shelter. But to me, the book also was just about vulnerability over and over and over again. You know, vulnerable after a car wreck, vulnerable at the doctor's office. And now, I mean, I hear you commenting on the vulnerability of being wealthy too. I mean, in a sense, right? That no one's ever really... So I want to know now, like, now that the book is written, it's a New York Times bestseller, what's your relationship to vulnerability?
Oh, I still feel that way. I feel that way every morning when I wake up and I know that I have an event that night. I am still introverted, and I feel the physical effects of that along with the mental. And so it is a very vulnerable place for me to stand in front of an audience, especially after several years of being a writer on the internet. I have received death threats. You know, I have received endless days of troll comments, and I am always sure that one of them is going to show up to an event and shout some like horrible thing at me. It never happens. And I actually walk away from events feeling connected with readers and feeling supported and loved in like a really genuine way. And that has been amazing. But there is still like this part of my body that's reacting in almost like a PTSD type of way. Just facing your audience literally face to face is still kind of scary when you've been through this horrible internet situation for so many years.
Right, right. Can you give listeners just a brief sketch of what you went through with the internet trolls?
Well, I mean, when the original article was published on Vox, I received hate messages for at least a month. And it was the first time that I had ever really published anything on like a big national platform. It was extremely overwhelming and surprising. I've had someone describe it as being caught in a tornado and a tidal wave at the same time. And all of these people are kind of screaming at you. I received countless messages calling me a cockroach and a vermin, that I should be in jail, my kids should be taken away from me. And then there's all of the pleasant cuss words and all of that stuff. Most are grammatically incorrect, which I try to enjoy. But I remember going outside and like a week after the Vox article was published and just going for a walk along the river with a friend of mine, feeling branches kind of hitting me and having this sense to duck down. I remember feeling that I felt so similarly to that just in my own home, that I was just kind of ducking and trying to avoid all of these comments coming at me constantly. I mean, at the time I didn't have a smartphone, so it was just coming through my computer. But another time that I went viral, and I did have a smartphone then, it was like every single time I looked at my phone, I had 20 plus notifications from Twitter and Facebook, emails and everything. And it was all full of hate, and it gets to you. I would say my humanity, or my sense of humanity and my outlook on people really changed for quite a long time.
Where do you stand with that today?
I think it's getting better. It's easy to feel isolated, especially in Missoula, Montana, and especially when you work from home and you have two kids and you don't get out much. So I think the more people that I'm meeting and the more that I'm seeing the good in people, it's really good for me. Because before, it just seemed like I experienced the worst parts of people more than I experienced the good parts.
I want to talk about connection. I happen to be reading your book alongside Michael Ondaatje's book Warlight. And in the book, he actually writes, "When you attempt a memoir, I am told, you need to be in an orphan state. So what is missing in you and the things you've grown cautious and hesitant about will come almost casually towards you. A memoir is the lost inheritance." What do you think your lost inheritance is?
I think it's being estranged from family and feeling so incredibly alone. I think that was my biggest downfall in my story, because I somewhat desperately searched for connection with people, sometimes I think detrimentally to my responsibilities as a parent. But it's a really hard thing to face, not only that you only have yourself to fall back on, but that it might be that way for a very long time. And there is a certain type of aloneness in that I think is not something that many people experience. And it really hardens you. So it was hard for me to write about that without letting the desperation come out on the page, even though it was a very desperate place.
You write about feeling emotionally orphaned by your parents, but the line that really broke my heart came in the middle of the book. "Sometimes mothers need to be mothered too." What can you've sort of spoken to this, but I'm just thinking about the connection between mothering and your struggle, you know, like what would have mothering looked like for you had you received it?
Oh, I just having a mom to call and having someone available on the other end of the line that had advice on what to do with a fever or advice on what to do with a picky eater or anything like that. Or just reassurance that I was doing a good job. It's like I just needed one person to tell me that I was a good mom. You want that to come from your own mom. And I never got that. It was really hard. I have friends who are very close to their mothers. Their moms genuinely love their kids and them. They're always sending packages and cards and their grandma. I wanted that for my daughter so much. But at the same time, I really needed my mom.
Can we talk about Mia a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I love talking about Mia.
I've seen some recent publicity photos and you guys are in these shots together. And I just want to know, like, what was it like for you to write your relationship with Mia? And what does she say about the process? And now you're on book tour. And
she's pretty proud of me. She enjoys it. She likes it that her principal and the secretary, and she just asked to give a signed copy to her teacher this morning. And she's reading the book right now. And she has like really weird questions. Like, are you sure that his eyes weren't green? Or, you know, little detail fact check things. But she hasn't responded much to the fact that the book is mostly about my relationship with her. So we haven't really gotten any deep discussions over it. But she's enjoying the fame, I think. But she's always been like that. She's always wanted to be center stage. And anytime her picture was in the local magazine or a, you know, nationally public type of publication, she got pretty excited. She would want to know, like, how many likes my post got or weird kid stuff that is foreign to me because yeah. It's taken a lot for me to publish the things that I have over the years. But she's so excited to be talked about in all of these circles all over.
In terms of the craft of writing memoir, I was also wondering how you approach the writing of sort of the villainous characters, the abusive exes, the disrespectful landlords.
I went into it not wanting to assume anything that they were thinking or what their motivations were. I tried to keep it as much my story as possible. But as far as like the situation with Mia's dad or abusive whatever, I didn't want to give them any space on the page. I didn't want to give them, I don't know, I didn't want to give them any part of my book other than my reactions to what was going on. But I also wrote this in mind that my daughter was going to read it someday, and I didn't want to do any more damage than had already been done. So I kept that very much in mind. I think a lot of the characters I honestly was pretty easy on. I could have talked about things that happened that were much worse, but I didn't really see the good in that. I felt like it was indulging the reader a little bit too much in things that I didn't really see important in progressing the narrative, and I kind of felt like we're similar to gossip, I guess.
That's Stephanie Land, author of Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and A Mother's Will to Survive, on the show The Right Question. We'll have the final segment of that conversation, but first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Officials with the North Dakota Department of Health say we are in a strong position when it comes to detecting and preventing the spread of the coronavirus in nursing homes and other care centers. Spokesman Tim Weidrich says after seeing an incident involving a nursing home in Washington State, the level of concern has been heightened. Weidrich says residents of long-term care facilities are a vulnerable population. He says because of that, special measures have to be taken.
Some of the residents in those facilities don't have the same level of resiliency that other people have. And so it's important, it's right that we pay attention to that and make sure that we're taking the appropriate steps.
Weidrich says even if there are no coronavirus cases in North Dakota, it's right and appropriate to take reasonable steps.
Not only do we have a plan, but we have trained on the plan, we've exercised the plan, we have a substantial medical cache so that those medical supplies that are necessary and no longer available in the private sector can in fact be provided to our medical providers within the state to carry on the activities that need to be carried on.
Weidrich says the plan includes an incident command process with a number of state and local agencies. North Dakota's insurance commissioner has issued a bulletin to all North Dakota health and travel insurance companies to waive cost-sharing requirements for COVID-19 testing. John Gottfried says the bulletin also encourages insurance companies to review other operations in preparation for the coronavirus in the state. North Dakota currently has no confirmed cases. Gottfried says waiving cost-sharing should help remove any barriers to potential patients getting proper tests and medical treatment.
We still have 100,000. We still have 100,000.
The wrong soundbite there. The bulletin also outlines 10 points the industry can employ to plan for the spread of COVID-19. It includes preparedness, access to information, testing, delivery of services, access to medications, and no surprise medical bills. Members of the Department of Transportation were flying drones at the state capitol in Bismarck on Wednesday. It was a training exercise as DOT prepares for the spring flood season.
We started using them last year where we experimented with them.
DOT's UAS Integration Program Administrator Russ Buchholz says the agency has 12 drones and he expects they will be used in central and eastern North Dakota this spring. So what will the drones be looking for?
First of all, ice jamming is a big concern. It raises havoc on our bridges. So we can monitor the ice jam and see what's going on. Plus, we can relay that information to like the Department of Emergency Services who are working, you know, in conjunction with them. And with that, you know, they can make vital decisions of what we need to do. And then also, if we need to open up a bridge, you know, we can inspect those bridges earlier on. And then we can, with doing that, you know, we can get those bridges open as soon as possible for the traveling public.
One of the newest drones, dubbed the Enterprise, has a strobe light and speakers.
So if you need to do search and rescue or we need to get the message out, we can use that as well.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Stephanie Land is the author of Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. It's about her experience being overworked and underpaid, something that she found is very common in the United States. And she's speaking with Sarah Aronson, who hosts the show from Montana Public Radio called The Right Question.
I was looking online this morning, Stephanie, and was like, oh my gosh, this book hit the New York Times bestseller list. And then I immediately had this thought, oh no, this book runs the risk of perpetuating the rags to riches American dream narrative. If you just keep at it, you'll become a New York Times bestseller. And so I want to know, like, what has it been like for you to ride this process? And do you find any, like, what's your story? What's this story going to be in the long run about getting out of poverty and reaching a certain level of fame?
Boy, I try to talk about how privileged my story is, how privileged my book is, how white my book is. I realize that so much. I just hope that I'm grabbing people's attention and they'll start listening to the millions of other stories behind it. But also, I'm not a success story as far as the government assistance programs are involved, or I don't consider myself a success story because that would mean that government assistance programs are successful. I got a book deal and I had this wild success with my career as a writer, and it's not something that I can say a handful of people I know personally have happened to. It's a really crazy thing that happened to me. I would hope that people would recognize that not everybody in poverty follows the same path that I'm on. I don't know. I think we want so much for this myth that we've been raised on of if you work hard in this country, then you'll make it and you'll be successful. And so I think the people who are kind of driving that myth down our throats like to point to people like me and say, see, if you work hard enough, you'll make it, when it's just really not true. there's absolutely no way that you can work hard enough when you're making $7 or $8 an hour and you have a family. I would hope that that would be kind of common sense in looking at my path that I've been on for the last few years. People would see like how unique that is. But also I would just hope that they realize that there are millions of others who are still struggling in way worse situations than I was, who may always struggle. I hope if I evoke some amount of empathy in them, then it'll make the people who are still struggling, it'll make their lives a little bit easier in the long run, because people might start voting differently. And that is the thing that I hope for the most to come out of this book.
We're doing this interview in Missoula, Montana, which in the book sort of acts like the promised land. Now that you've been here for a while, what's your reflection about that dream?
But I think I had a good hunch. Yeah. It worked out. It continues to work out. As much as I don't like absolutely no direct flights out of this town, it takes a whole entire day to fly somewhere, Missoula is still worth it. I love the surroundings. I love the people. I love how in love people are with Missoula. And that's a special thing. I can see my daughter still making connections with people. And I feel like we found our people here. As much as I have days where I don't like it here, there are a lot more where I truly do.
Stephanie Land is a New York Times bestselling author and former house cleaner. She lives with her two daughters in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
Coming up next on Main Street, Poetry Out Loud.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Barb Gravel, host of the television show Prairie Musicians on Prairie Public, Oakland.
Break out these chains, let's burn it down.
Anchorage. New Orleans.
Rice Krispie treats and noodles. Home alone, Macaulay Culkin. Cause sometimes, I need more space than sauce can give me. More sky than God provides me.
Columbus, Georgia. What do these places have in common? They're some of the hometowns of NPR's Tiny Desk Contest winners. The 2020 edition is on, and we'd love to see someone from North Dakota, Eastern Montana, or Northwest Minnesota win it all this year. So Prairie musicians over 18, sound check, and then film yourself performing an original song in front of the Tiny Desk of your choice. Then upload it onto YouTube and do a little dance for luck, because it'll be judged by a distinguished panel that includes multiple Grammy winner Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes. The winner will perform at the iconic Tiny Desk in D.C., and embark on a 10-city U.S. concert tour with NPR Music. Entries must be in by March 30th. Just go to npr.org/tinydeskcontest for complete rules and to upload your clip.
Are you ready?
We're so thrilled to welcome the winner of the Tiny Desk Contest!
The 2020 NPR Tiny Desk Contest. Go for it, Prairie musicians!
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg in studio with Director of Radio Bill Thomas, who recently judged the North Dakota Poetry Out Loud presentation. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Yes, I was one of several judges, and it was quite an experience just paying that close attention to these students reciting poems from memory.
And we've had a couple segments on this, so I'll be brief. It's students from across the state who have practiced poems that they're allowed to choose from a book, something more ancient, something more recent. They recite them from memory. They get judged. Then they go on to a national competition.
You got it.
All right. Well, we should hear one. We have, what do we got?
Cassandra Rostvet. She's from Northwood High School, and this is... You know, you mentioned, and I realized, a lot of these students pick a little bit dark poems sometimes.
So anyway, angst, man.
Yeah, this is Dead Butterfly, she'll say.
Dead Butterfly by Ellen Bass.
For months, my daughter carried a dead monarch in a quart mason jar. To and from school in her backpack, to her only friend's house. At the dinner table, it sat like a guest alongside the pot roast. She took it to bed, propped by her pillow. Was it the year her brother was born? Was this her own too fragile baby that had lived so briefly in its glass world? Or the year she refused to go to her father's house? Was this the holding her breath girl she became there? This plump child in her rolled-down socks, I sometimes wanted to haul back inside me and carry safe again. What was her fierce commitment? I never understood. We just lived with the dead winged thing as part of her, as part of us. Weightless in its heavy jar.
Oh, wow. You can say so much without using the words, you know, referencing what this child actually was probably dealing with.
Yes.
Like a stillborn or an infant death in her own family.
And this is where you hear the students study these poems.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear that.
Yeah. You have an interview with a fellow judge, Shanane Tangney. She is a retired English professor from Minot State University, and this was her first year judging the Poetry Out Loud competition.
So this is your first time at Poetry Out Loud. You're being a judge, which means you have to pay intense attention to every recitation. And you've seen people do poetry before, I'm certain, but how does this event strike you?
This is a great event. I love any event where we can hear poetry out loud the way it should be. The students are so earnest and talented, and they're giving it their all, and I'm just really having a good time. I'm delighted to be here.
Do you see certain patterns or kind of things to look for in the readings that interest you?
Well, I like poetry sort of straight up and not over-dramatized, and I think the students are doing a really good job with that. They seem to be very clear as to the poem's meaning and delivering it in a genuine, honest way, and that really pleases me, not acting it or gussying it up in some way.
Yeah, and it's a lot of people think of this when they hear about it, they think, oh, it's like a poetry slam, and the poetry slams tend to be extremely expressive.
Yeah, and this is, you know, the students are reading the work of other poets, not their own. So that can be a little tricky. You know, you don't live inside the other writer's mind and know exactly what that poet had intended. But I think that's what I mean by they seem to be smart readers and have a good sense of the poem's meaning and just give it a straightforward, genuine delivery, not all the emoting that seems to happen at poetry slams.
Part of the process for the students, I think, is figuring out somebody else's poem.
Yeah, and I was interested when we got all our, you know, judges' materials, what the criteria are, to see that understanding the meaning of the poem is one of the criteria. And again, I'm really impressed with the level of intellect of these high school kids.
Were there any particular moments that jumped out at you in the readings, that ones that you went like, wow, that was great?
Well, yeah, I did. I noticed myself, and, you know, I'm not going to give away who I think is winning because we haven't got to the finals yet, but notice myself sort of sitting up straighter or cocking my head, being really captured by four or five of the readers here today.
Yeah. Well, and coincidentally, there are five finalists to be chosen, so.
I did not know that.
You know, it's an effort for the schools to do this, and they have to squeeze it in. We know that there's so many curriculum requirements on the high schools, and they've got to somehow shoehorn poetry in like this too.
Yeah, kudos to all the teachers who coach the students, obviously work with the students in understanding, reciting, performing, having a stage presence, working on the quality of their voice and their delivery. Yeah, I can't congratulate the teachers who participate in this enough. Good for them.
You know, she brings up a good point, and that was Shanine Tagney. She is a retired English professor from Minot State University, and she is a first-time judge at Poetry Out Loud. And talking about the students and the teachers, of course, the state winner goes on to the national competition.
Correct.
Is there any kind of recognition for the teachers, even just like a round of applause? Good
job.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. They get a lot of recognition at the event,
okay.
And I know a lot of appreciation from the Arts Council.
All right.
Now, the next one, it's read by Katie Meester, and she's from Valley City High. And this is a poem that I've seen chosen a few years in a row. It's a strange mixture of light and dark.
Requests for Toy Piano by Tony Hoagland. Play the one about the family of the ducks, where the ducks go down to the river, and one of them thinks the water will be cold. But then they jump in anyway, and like it, and splash around. No, I must play the one about the nervous man from Palestine, in row 14, with a brown bag in his lap in which a gun is hidden in a sandwich. Play the one about the handsome man and woman standing on the steps of her apartment, and how the darkness and her perfume and the beating of their hearts conjoin to make them feel like leaping from the edge of chance. No, I should play the one about the hard rectangle of the credit card hidden in the man's back pocket, and how the woman spent an hour plucking out her brows, and how her perfume was made from the destruction of 100 flowers. Then play the one about the flower industry, in which the migrant workers curse their own infected hands from tossing sheaves of roses and carnations into the back of the refrigerated trucks. No, I must play the one about the single yellow daffodil standing on my kitchen table, whose cut stem draws the water upwards so the plant is flushed with the conviction that the water has been sent to find and to raise it up from somewhere so deep inside the earth not even flowers can remember.
Kind of hopeful ending, I guess.
There was a lot in that one.
Well, listen to this next one. This is sort of a nature poem, except it also has great sardonic comment on human nature as well as animal nature. This is Jacob Clout, who's from Beulah High.
Eagle Plain by Robert Francis. The American eagle is not aware he is the American eagle. He is never tempted to look modest. When orators advertise the American eagle's virtues, the American eagle is not listening. This is his virtue. He is somewhere else. He is mountains away. But even if he were near, he would never make an audience. The American eagle never says he will serve if drafted, will dutifully serve, etc. He is not at our service. If we have honored him, we have honored one who unequivocally honors himself by overlooking us. He does not know the meaning of magnificent. Perhaps we do not altogether either. Who cannot touch him?
Ooh, yeah. I like that.
Huh?
Yeah.
Short, it's a lot in there.
We are the ones who have to infuse everything with, you know, some kind of meaning, and these animals are just being.
Yeah.
Good job, birds.
All right. Well, this next one is also a very short and punchy one. It's almost like a punchline, but it's not a joke. This is Gabby Oberg from Washburn.
Prince by Joseph Bruschak. Seeing photos of ancestors a century past is like looking at your own fingerprints. Circles and lines you can't recognize until someone else with a stranger's eye looks close and says, "That's you."
Yeah, you can hear them clapping. Joseph Bruschak, by the way, is a Native American poet. Mm. So knowing that makes that different, too.
Do you judge a poem a little differently? Like, obviously, that one was read in just 34 seconds, but this one about toy piano, it took more than 2 minutes. Do you have to kind of figure out how to judge not just the poem, but the recitation of the poem when they're very different styles?
Right, and they actually changed the criteria where it used to be you kind of got extra credit for doing a longer poem. Mm. And they changed that a couple of years ago. And they said, like, don't give them points for just going long. I mean, it's good if they did a longer one and they memorized it well. That's mm-hmm. great. But
it isn't necessarily better or stronger.
Right.
Okay. Well, what else do we have?
Another, this one's kind of a dark one, too. And this is by a high school student from Windmere. I really liked her readings, Alexandra Pitts.
The Albatross by Kate Bass. When I know you are coming home, I put on this necklace. Glass beads on a silken thread, a blue that used to match my eyes. I like to think I am remembering you. I like to think you don't forget. The necklace lies heavy on my skin. It clatters when I reach down to lift my screaming child. I swing her, roll her in my arms until she forgets. The beads glitter in the flicker of a TV set as I sit her on my lap and wish away the afternoon. I wait until I hear a gate latch lift, the turn of key and lock. I sit amongst toys and unwashed clothes. I sit as she fingers the beads until you speak. In a voice that no longer seems familiar, only strange. I turn as our child tugs at the string. I hear a snap and a sound like falling rain.
And Alexandra was one of the state winners alongside Katie, who you heard do the toy piano, and Cassandra, who did the first poem of this segment, The Dead Butterfly. Maria Kolb from St. Mary's Central went on to win to the state competition. We have one more poem for today.
Yes, and this is by Kylie, also a winner.
Then and Now by Tom Clark. Then it was always for now, later for later. And then years of now passed, and it grew later and later. Trapped in the shrinking chocolate box, the confused sardine was unhappy. It leapt and banged its head again. And afterward they said, "Shall we repeat the experiment?" And it said, "Later for that."
Wow. That was Bill Thomas sharing selections from the Poetry Out Loud competition recently held in Bismarck. Thanks, Bill.
We should say thanks to the North Dakota Council on the Arts, National Endowment for the Arts, and the Poetry Foundation.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 11th, celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
North Dakota women received partial suffrage in 1917 after Governor Frazier signed a bill that mirrored similar legislation in Illinois. The bill granted women the right to vote for presidential electors who would represent the state in the Electoral College and certain other officers, and to participate and vote on certain matters and in certain elections. Essentially, the bill let women vote on anything except where they were expressly prohibited by the state constitution. To get anything else required a constitutional amendment. So, while North Dakota women were still waiting for full suffrage, they were eligible to participate in the 1920 presidential election. Sort of. Of course, complications arose as the date of the primary drew near. At the Republican State Convention in February, Minnie Nielsen, Superintendent of Public Instruction, was nominated to serve as delegate to the National Republican Convention. Her nomination was greeted by tumultuous cheering, which continued for 5 minutes. Back then, nominees to serve as delegates in national party conventions were subject to statewide election. However, Attorney General Langer told Nielsen she should not file for the position because, according to the North Dakota Constitution, people who didn't have the right to vote for an office couldn't become a candidate for that office. The 1917 law only granted women the right to vote for presidential electors, not for delegates to national conventions. William Lumpke, vice president of the Nonpartisan League, a supporter of women's suffrage, filed a lawsuit insisting that if women had the right to vote on presidential electors, they should be able to vote for intermediaries, such as delegates. While this was all under debate, at the last minute, another woman was added to the ballot, Mrs. M. A. Rudd of Fargo, a League Republican candidate. In the end, the state Supreme Court allowed these two women to remain on the ballot, but the court did not say women could vote in the delegate race. So on women's ballots, that race was not included. The Grand Forks Herald noted, "Doubtless if the situation had been understood when the Women's Franchise Act was passed, the office of delegate would have been included. In any line of human activity other than the making of laws, there is usually some careful checking up on a new regulation before it is adopted. In the matter of legislation, we proceed cheerfully by guess and trust to luck for the result." I'm Sarah Walker.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Around the world, countries are responding differently to the coronavirus crisis.
We're still very much in the up cycle of this epidemic.
And some health experts say lessons from abroad don't bode well for the U.S.
I still don't understand why we don't have extensive testing. It's been stunning to me how bad the federal response has been.
That's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're hoping to visit with longtime Bismarck travel agent Catherine Satram to comment on the impact of the coronavirus on the state and on the businesses that might rely on tourism dollars. We're also going to hear from Sue Balcom as she has some tips about starting plants. Yes, it is time to get those seeds ready to go in the ground. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.